This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iraqi forces raise the flag over Ramadi. The U.S. prepares for a new year in the Pacific.
The balancing act, if you will, between trying to reassure allies and partners in Southeast Asia in particular, but all throughout Asia, that the U.S. is there, is responsive to its military alliance commitments.
Prison food takes on a whole new meaning. A Shakespeare classic plays at the movies. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Iraqi army units supported by Sunni tribal fighters and a mostly Shiite police brigade have captured the center of the Anbar province capital, Ramadi. The national flag was raised over the main government compound in Ramadi Monday, 7 months after Islamic State militants captured the western city. The apparent victory by Iraqi security forces, backed by U.S.-led airstrikes, is the biggest since the IS group came on the scene in force 18 months ago. Edward Uranian has details from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Iraqi state TV broadcast grainy footage of government forces climbing onto the roof of Ramadi's municipal headquarters and raising the Iraqi flag. The city center fell to Islamic State militants in May when soldiers defending the same government complex fled. Provincial Governor Suhaib Rawi addressed residents of Anbar. He says that retaking the government complex from Islamic State marks the start of the liberation of the rest of Anbar province. He thanks tribal fighters, the Iraqi Air Force, and the Prime Minister for helping to win the battle so families can return to their homes. He also thanks U.S.-led coalition forces for providing air cover for the operation. Video of Ramadi city center and other nearby districts showed widespread destruction and many neighborhoods appeared to be in ruins. One military commander told state TV that Islamic State militants had booby-trapped many buildings and attacked his men with car bombs. He says that his men made sacrifices and many gave up their lives in the bitter battle against Islamic State, which hit them with car bombs, mines, and by rigging buildings. Provincial Governor Rawi claimed that 1,000 Islamic State fighters were killed in the battle to recapture Ramadi. Arab media reported, however, that many fled through tunnels and escaped across the Euphrates River, which runs north of the city. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
There remains uncertainty, however, as some Iraqi military leaders say Ramadi's been liberated, while others contend parts of the city remain under Islamic State control. A U.S. military official says Islamic State fighters had been driven out of critical infrastructure in Ramadi, but declined to declare a total victory for Iraqi forces in the city. Middle East regional analyst Amin Saikal of the Australian National University in Canberra tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that regaining control of Ramadi would not only be a big victory for the Iraqi government, but a significant loss by the Islamic State, which also gave up the area around the strategic Tishrin Dam in northern Syria to a rebel alliance known as the Syrian Democratic Forces. He says it took Iraqi forces weeks to complete their assault on Ramadi.
Yeah, and it's not the end of the story yet. I mean, it is very possible that the Islamic State may launch a counterattack. And also, as far as the latest news is concerned, there is still fighting going on in and around Ramadi. So I don't think the Iraqi armed forces can declare a full victory at this point. But of course, they are very close to achieving a victory.
Despite the fall of Tikrit to Iraqi forces earlier this year, this is being considered the biggest victory in 18 months since Islamic State made its presence known in Iraq.
Well, that is absolutely true. And of course, that will also boost the morale of the Iraqi forces and will enable them in cooperation with the Kurdish militia Peshmerga to make a very strong push towards the second largest city of Iraq, that's Mosul, which has been under the control of the Islamic State since June last year.
Well, that's going to be a much bigger test for the Iraqi security forces.
Absolutely, because the Mosul is highly urbanized, and the Islamic State has embedded most of its military assets as well as its fighters among the population. So therefore, I think the risk of higher civilian casualties would be something that the Iraqi forces and the international coalition would have to really take into account. And that may well not make it easy for them to make us push into Mosul as easily as some people may have anticipated.
Is this a political victory for Haider al-Abadi, the Prime Minister?
Well, it is a victory of a kind, but of course one must not really forget that Mr. al-Abadi had promised last year that they were going to take over Ramadi within a very short space of time. Within days and weeks, but of course that never really materialized. And it's taken them almost a year to make a trust into Ramadi, and does not necessarily mean that they're going to have a sort of a similar easy victory in relation to Mosul.
What does this all mean for the Islamic State? Has it reached its peak, or is it still a major menace that is spreading?
Well, it is still a source of important menace for the region as well as beyond the region. And also it shows that the Islamic State is contained. It has not really achieved any major territorial victory in the last several months, and they're also losing grounds to some extent in Syria, and they have lost some strategic points, but that does not necessarily mean that this is the end of the Islamic State.
Amin Saikal, regional analyst of the Australian National University, also says the Islamic State is still capable of putting up strong resistance. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beattie. The White House is expected to host the leaders of Asia-Pacific nations in the coming year. It will occur as the U.S. continues to push American power and influence in the area. But the Obama administration will face challenges as it seeks to further engage the region without increasing tensions with China. White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas has more.
Good afternoon, everybody.
President Barack Obama says America must be linked to the Asia-Pacific.
The Asia-Pacific is absolutely critical to promoting security, prosperity, and human dignity around the world. That's why I've devoted so much of my foreign policy to deepening America's engagement with this region.
In a bid to solidify the U.S. as a leader there, Obama has hosted regional leaders at the White House and met with others during multiple trips to the region. But the U.S. goal to create a peaceful and prosperous Asia-Pacific also hinges on Congress and whether it will ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement in 2016. The massive trade deal faces tough opposition. Analyst Christopher Johnson.
In most parts of Asia, economics is security.
Maritime disputes in the South China Sea will also continue to be a challenge, says analyst Mark Noland.
China's territorial claims and other actions have created anxiety among many of the smaller countries in the region, so they welcome the United States' presence. At the same time, they don't want to get drawn into confrontations between the United States and China.
The U.S. must walk a fine line, says Johnson.
The balancing act, if you will, between trying to reassure allies and partners in Southeast Asia in particular, but all throughout Asia, that the U.S. is there as responsive to its military alliance commitments with regard to growing Chinese activism in the region, but not make it look to the Chinese as if it's a containment strategy to try to damage China's interests in the region.
The U.S. has committed to helping Southeast Asian nations build up their maritime capabilities and called on China to halt reclamation, new construction, and militarization of disputed areas in the South China Sea. Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, the White House.
Staying in Asia, it's time now to check out what's trending online with our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray.
Well, G, apparently making news today, South Korea and Japan have settled for an agreement on the issue of comfort women. Can you tell us about the gist of it first?
Sure. So we're talking about the Japanese Imperial Army's systematic torture and sexual slavery of at least 20,000 women during the World War II. The Chinese scholars' figures go up to 410,000 victims. Now, most of these victims were Korean teenage girls, but they also include Chinese, Southeast Asians, and those of European origin like Dutch and Australian girls. And on Monday, foreign ministers from Japan and South Korea agreed on the reparation of $8.3 million to aid the 46 surviving victims, all of them in their 80s and 90s. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, for the first time ever, also directly apologized for the atrocity.
So, gee, is the online community having any reaction to this?
Yes, and it seems like the only ones pleased with the settlement, at least online, are Washington, Seoul, and Tokyo governments. If you turn to the comment section of a New York Times article on the issue, you will see that quite clearly. A reader named Joshua Schwartz in the U.S. wrote this comment, which about 100 people liked. He begins by mentioning the photo of the two foreign ministers shaking hands. Good picture at the top of the article. Two men come to an agreement about Japanese men abusing Korean women. $8.3 million also seems a little low, even bearing in mind that relatively few of these women still are living. The women were missing from the negotiation table, says Hiroka Shoji, a woman and researcher at Amnesty International. It seems that future Korean-Japanese interests, bilateral ties, might have played a bigger role than justice for the women. The women do not seem too happy. I will ignore it completely, says 88-year-old Lee Yong-soo about the agreement. Another reader named Marie in Luxembourg wrote this comment. What the women wanted was the admittance of responsibility and a full and unreserved apology by Japan. And what does Japan do? They wash their hands clean with $8.3 million, request the removal from Korean soil of the statue that serves as a reminder of their crime, and get a concession from Korea to never criticize them on this issue again. Now, on the other hand, the U.S. State Department tweeted this. U.S. applauds leaders of Japan and the Republic of Korea for reaching an agreement on the issue of comfort women. That's all for me today.
Thank you, G. You can follow her on Twitter at GAVLee and all of us on IE at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar at voanews.com and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. With New Year's just ahead, you may be planning a special meal or two for the occasion. One food item not normally considered is ramen noodles. It's long been a staple for students and young people just starting out, or those struggling to make ends meet because it's inexpensive and easy to make. Now, from a prison in California, former inmate Gustavo Goose Alvarez and his childhood friend Clifton Collins Jr., a Los Angeles-based actor who's appeared in such films as Pacific Rim, Transcendence, and Titanic, have published a book called Prison Ramen. Clifton Collins spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about how this idea started.
I went to go visit him. I just returned from Iowa because I was shooting The Experiment with Adrian Brody and Forrest Whitaker. And we'd had our own little fake movie riot. Unbeknownst to me, I walk into the production office and I see that Chino had their own riot. So I was like, oh my God, my dude's over there. So I try to get a hold of family and friends to find out if he's okay. And then when I came home and the prison got off a lockdown, I went to go visit him. And he pitched me this idea about a ramen cookbook because that's what everybody eats in there. And also at the end of the night when the riot was over, they left all the inmates outside, but the Goose was inside, and he was able to get a bunch of the inmates together to cook a big old ramen spread, and they were able to feed the inmates through the door. They'd make these dishes of ramen. They would feed everybody all night long until the sun came up.
Now, this riot was between two different groups of prisoners, correct?
Yeah, between the blacks and Latinos. But once the riots are over, it's business as usual. And at the end of the day, everybody knows that they're all under the same roof in the same prison. So, you know, that compassion kicks in and, you know, humanity kicks in.
And in this case, it was ramen that kicked in, something that really brought everybody together.
Yes, sir. It certainly did. And it did for this book, too. I mean, it got me to sit down with all, a bunch of different, my different celebrity friends. I've got many more that want to do book two now. When others get to learn from your mistakes and they don't have to actually do your mistake, that's a beautiful thing.
How much of a surprise was it to you when your friend pitched you this idea?
I mean, my jaw hit the floor. It's like I'm sitting there at a table on the yard and I can still smell the burnt ashes from the dorms. He's like, I got an idea. Ramen cookbook. What do you think, Cliff? I'm like, okay. Are you all right? Yo, there's a riot here. Are you okay? Yeah, but a ramen cookbook, Cliff. Yeah, I heard you. So it was like, then we got into it, and I got the sentiment of it and the emotions and the intent behind it. That was profoundly beautiful to me. And I thought, how do we bring more of this message out? How do we touch more people? Because people are in and out of prison all the time, and there's different forms of incarceration. There's college, financial incarceration, emotional, love. So this is definitely a special book. And we donate a portion of the proceeds to Homeboy and Father Greg, which is a beautiful thing.
Clifton, I'm sure you've had plenty of ramen in your day, but were you surprised by some of the recipes that came out of this?
No, not at all. I've been around it too long. You know what? I take that back. There might have been a couple little like, huh? the ramen agra we had to talk about, the ramen agra for the conjugal visit. I was like, come on, man. Oysters and clams and then... I mean, he put his stamp of approval on. He says, Cliff, trust me, dude. This is what the homies, when the lady comes and you need to impress, this is what you eat. I'm like, okay, I'll take your word for it.
So it's food that really transitions out of prison into normal life.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you'd be amazed at how many of my friends I was talking to where I had to confess that I started eating ramen again. And they started laughing and would take me into their kitchen and open up a drawer filled with ramen.
Now that you're embarking on a second book, do you find that more difficult to be more creative, or are there that many more recipes out there?
Oh, there are a slew of recipes. We're not into the second book yet, but I've already got quite a few people coming up to me for book number two.
As our listeners get their hands on this book and look through some of the recipes, are there things that they need to be aware of as they try to do this at home versus how these were concocted in prison?
They're easier to cook, obviously, because you're not in jail. They're all just delicious dishes, man. You just got to sit down and freaking go into them, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Clifton, great job on this. Thank you so much, and give our
Thank
best to Goose as well.
Most definitely. I appreciate you, man. Thank you so much.
That's actor Clifton Collins, Jr. The book is titled Prison Ramen, Recipes and Stories from Behind Bars. It's available from Workman Publishing. This is VOA. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. William Shakespeare's tragedy Macbeth gets a new treatment from Australian director Justin Kurzel. The film stars Oscar winner Marion Cotillard and Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender as a doomed Scottish king and his ambitious wife. International Edition's David Byrd takes a look.
Director Justin Kurzel's Macbeth opens with the title character and his wife standing next to the grave of their only child. Their grief then transitions into a blood-soaked battle scene, after which a victorious Macbeth meets three witches who tell him that he shall be king of Scotland.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Clumps.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
All hail Macbeth, it shall be king hereafter.
There's only one problem. Scotland has a king, Duncan, whom Lady Macbeth, played by Marion Cotillard, persuades her reluctant husband to murder when Duncan visits their castle.
I have given suck, and know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out had I so sworn, as you have done to this.
Michael Fassbender, known for his roles in Shame, Inglourious Basterds, and the X-Men series, says taking on the role of the doomed Scot was something that required a lot from him.
There's just so many endless versions you can do and various sort of interpretations of it. It's just, which is very encouraging and also kind of depressing, because I would walk away thinking, God, you know, there was another thousand ways that could have been done. But just really becoming comfortable with it.
Cotillard, who won an Oscar for her portrayal of Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose, says she was reluctant to take the part until she talked to director Justin Kurzel.
The way he talked about the fact that he wanted to show that they were in love with each other, and they wanted, and he wanted to show, yeah, the humanity of those two people, really got me, and gave me the desire to be part of it.
Fassbender says Cotillard brought a new vision to the role and was a joy to work with.
She's a really very sort of unique actor, and the fact that she sort of really works very much in the moment-to-moment sort of elements of a scene. She doesn't come forcing something on a scene. She allows it to sort of organically sort of take place, and that's pretty rare.
The film was shot on location on Scotland's Isle of Skye, and the weather and the landscape play a large role in the story. Kurzel's vision also has the characters working in spare surroundings, not grand castles, but empty, dark, cold landscapes. Battle scenes take place on muddy, wet hillsides, which also add to the feeling of desperation and isolation. Macbeth also stars David Thewlis as Duncan, Paddy Considine as Banquo, and Elizabeth Debicki as the ill-fated Lady Macduff. Macbeth is rated R for strong violence and brief sexuality. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, podcasts, and videos on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The death of a mother is the greatest misfortune for a young family. When a woman dies in childbirth, the newborn's own chances of survival diminish tenfold. That child and any siblings are less likely to receive health care and to go to school, and the family as a whole is now more likely to suffer economic hardship. Yet every 2 minutes, another mother dies during pregnancy or childbirth. More than half of the deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. That is why in June 2012, the United States and the government of Norway partnered with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the private sector initiative Merck for Mothers, and the Every Mother Counts campaign to found the Saving Mothers Giving Life initiative. Saving Mothers Giving Life is a 5-year initiative that seeks to reduce maternal mortality by half and improve health in places where women are dying at alarming rates during pregnancy and childbirth. It was initially implemented in 4 districts each in Uganda and Zambia, with a focus on labor, delivery, and the first 48 hours postpartum, the time period in which some 2/3 of maternal deaths and nearly half of infant deaths occur. Early reports indicated that the program was working, so it was expanded in 2014 to an additional 12 districts in Zambia and another 6 districts in Uganda. Now the program has reached its halfway point, and the results are astonishingly good. In Uganda, the institutional maternal mortality rate has fallen by 45% since the beginning of the initiative, and thanks to a strong training and educational campaign, by 41% at the community level. In Zambia, institutional mortality, meaning in a hospital or clinic, has fallen by 53% in the target districts, and nearly 90% of women are now giving birth in a facility compared to 63% at the outset of the initiative. As a result of this success, the partnership is expanding the program to Nigeria, a country that accounts for 14% of the world's maternal deaths and 1/4 of the world's newborn deaths, with an initial focus on the southeastern state of Cross River. Surviving childbirth should not be a matter of luck or where you live or how much money you have. Together, we are working to make that a reality.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.